From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Hilary Rell is my guest. Her marvelous debut novel is called Lessons in French. And she's actually sitting right here with me, so let me just say, Hilary Rell, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Since your book is a novel, Lessons in French, and I don't like to give anything away. I don't want to be the spoiler. So,
right.
What do you think listeners should know, you know, about your book before we talk about it?
Well, it's a coming of age novel set in Paris in 1990 about an American college graduate with a developing moral compass who shows up in Paris and works for a very impressive artist boss. And has a very sort of complicated older, younger woman relationship with her. And she's extremely impressionable and eager to please in the beginning and sort of identifies with almost every other character in the book because they seem so much more interesting and powerful than she is. And she ends up sort of with allegiances all over the place, feeling like she's in some kind of Picasso painting. And in the meantime, she's sort of trying to find herself as an artist. And slowly, as the book progresses, she learns. Well, I'm sorry.
I'll stop you.
I'm summarizing it.
It struck me that it was really a story about family and the boundaries and definitions of family. Is that what you're going for?
Very much so. It's what I thought about as I was writing it was sort of the tendency you have when you're young to go somewhere and forge families and create these little cells and try to fit in, and it's just figuring out how real those families are.
Because you've left home and you've left your actual family.
You've left home and you've left your actual family, in her case, her actual family was a little splintered, and she didn't quite know what her actual family was. So, but yeah, it's very much about that, I think.
And your heroine, she seems a little bit. I mean, I don't know that much about you.
Right.
But on the other hand, I know a little bit about you. So I think maybe she is a little bit like you. How much of this is a memoir and how much of it is completely invented?
I would say that the emotional truth of it is an emotional truth. It's definitely, I lived in Paris in 1990, and I did have a similar experience, although I've fictionalized it, I definitely had that desire to forge a family somewhere.
Well, so why do you think what made you decide to write about this and to write about it as fiction rather than just write your memoir?
I think, well, I definitely, let me start by saying why I wanted to write about Paris and that period.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was such an incredible time to be in Paris, 1990. The Berlin Wall was coming down. There was all the Muslim stuff was going on with Salman Rushdie. It was the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. I mean, it was such a rich and kind of unnerving and wonderful time to be in Paris. And I definitely wanted to recreate that. But I didn't think that the arc of my particular story was a novel or was interesting enough to actually constitute.
So by fictionalizing it, you could make it more interesting.
I could make it much more interesting, and much more narratively satisfying. I hope it's more narratively satisfying.
Right, because you could make your characters do whatever you wanted, whereas in real life,
you can't make them do anything. I mean, I guess you can lie, but...
it is an interesting period, and your book starts in 1989, right? And goes over into 1990, which is an interesting period for us. We're taping this in Santa Cruz, California. And in October of 1989, we had a huge earthquake here. And it was the biggest earthquake that we've had in our area since 1905, so 06, whenever the other quake was. Remember that other one? And I remember that then the wall came down, like a couple of weeks later.
Right.
And Crosby, Stills, and Nash were here, and they gave a little concert for us at the Catalyst. And then about a week later, they were at the wall giving a concert there. And I said, wait a minute.
What about us?
Those guys. We'll give a concert for anybody. But so I really, I kind of, you know, I was really into the era that you were talking about, and although you're in Paris, you know, you're in Europe, and the Berlin Wall coming down is a big deal and all that. And you created some really interesting characters, but what about the character that of the woman that your character is working for? Is that based on a real person, or were you in a similar situation?
I was in a similar situation. I've definitely romanticized it, mm-hmm. but where, I mean, this book has been called sort of a cross between The Devil Wears Prada and the autobiography of Alice B. Tolkas, which I think is pretty apt. Mm-hmm. So she was a great artist, the woman I was working for, and I was quite impressed by that. But it was also a very, very complicated and slightly abusive relationship. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was interesting. I've made it much, much more interesting than it really was. But I think those feelings and the relationship between a young, impressionable woman and an older artist, it is fascinating. She was a character that I've remained fascinated with, but I think it's more just the dynamic that I think is fascinating. And I've had it in several other times in my life. So it's not specifically her so much as the relationship, I think.
Mm-hmm. And the kind of blood is thicker than water theme of the story. Do you know what I mean by that?
Coming to her true family at the end.
Yeah.
That's actually the part that's the most fictional.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's that's what I mean by it, sort of the narrative satisfaction.
Yeah. But there is a kind of, I mean, in that way, it's kind of a cautionary tale, right, about who, you know, who really is. I mean, the thing is about family, even though my particular family, right. Oh, I better not say anything. Really. But the thing about family being, you know, your actual family,
right.
And the, you know, you choose your friends, but you can't choose your family. Right.
And you also can't, there's no one who's going to give you that unconditional love. And I think that what you're looking for when you're still, as you're coming into adulthood, is that unconditional love combined with the freedom to choose your own friends.
Mm-hmm.
And the realization that you can't get that, I think, is quite heartbreaking. And I remember figuring that out and just being so traumatized and blown away, but also feeling like I'd really grown up.
Yeah.
Like, you can't expect people who aren't part of your family to love you when you totally screw them over. And, you know, or maybe you didn't intend to, but whatever. It just, you don't get that from the real world. And it's a great lesson. And I think everybody learns it in some way or another. And I just learned it against this very dramatic and sort of fascinating backdrop.
So I thought it was a good
theme for a book.
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking with Hilary Rill, and her book is called Lessons in French, her new novel. You mentioned the kind of shaky moral compass that the main character has, and in some ways it made me think of, you know, the kind of crime noir fiction, in that, you know, like in James M. Cain novels, where the protagonist just is, he's just going along, and it just seems like the easiest thing in the world to commit this crime, because,
right.
I mean, you would do it too, because, you know, whatever. And not that anything like that occurs in the story, but everything that your character does, your heroine, she doesn't put a whole lot of thought into it. It all just seems to happen to her in the most natural way. And it's not until later, when she reflects on it, that she sees, oh, maybe that was wrong, or maybe I wasn't being honest, or maybe I wasn't being loyal. Loyalty is a big theme in the story too.
Right. Well, I think her problem, if she has the crux of it, is almost she's over empathic. Like, she just empathizes with everyone in the moment, and it's more than an eagerness to please. It's real empathy. Like, she just cares about them and feels for them, and so she's their friend then,
mm-hmm.
without necessarily reflecting on what that might mean.
Implications of it.
The implications of it. And I think her growth out of that is, that's what, I think, to me, that's what a coming of age novel is, or at least this one.
Yeah. The family aspect of it, that's where I think the little bit that I know about you. Mm-hmm. I know that your father was a film director.
Right.
And that he suffered from throat cancer, and therefore he lost his career because he didn't speak. That's kind of a similar situation than that your heroine has in this story. Yes?
It is a similar situation. The chronology of it is completely different. Because the characters in the novel, the character's father has died when she was, you know, very, very young. 12 years old, mm-hmm. and my father didn't die till I was almost 30.
Uh-huh.
But when I was writing the book, yeah. I was missing him very much.
Yeah.
So I think I was able to transpose that sense of loss onto my character. So.
Well, let's talk about your father a little bit, Tim Whalen.
Yeah.
And he was a film director. And he's also he was the son of two famous film people. Your grandmother and your grandfather. Your grandfather was Timothy Whalen, also.
Right.
And he was a film director. And tell me about your grandmother. She was a movie star.
My grandmother was adorable. I don't know. I mean, in my mind, she was a movie star, but she actually was. She was a movie star. She was. Her name was Miriam Seeger. She was one of five sisters from Kokomo, Indiana,
mm-hmm.
who were all in the theater when they were younger. She was completely adorable, little blonde, blue-eyed. Sort of Jane type, you know, and she was in a lot of sort of early talkies.
Yeah, and in some silent films too.
And in a couple of late silent films, but mostly early talkies. And then she was swept off her feet by an older director.
Uh-huh.
They moved to England and had an incredibly glamorous life leading up to World War II.
And
she stopped acting.
She stopped acting. Lived until she was 103 years old.
She just died a little over a year ago.
Wow.
She lived until she was 103, and she slept in white gloves with lotion under them until she was about 102.
She looked very beautiful.
Yeah, she was beautiful.
Yeah.
She was beautiful. And very, so she was sort of my glamorous.
Yeah.
My glamorous grandmother.
Well, now her husband died before you were born.
Her husband died way before I was born, and then she had an amazing life, actually. And then she reinvented herself and became an interior decorator to the stars.
Mm.
And she decorated Fred Astaire's house in the lobby of the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Wow.
She was amazing.
And
worked into her 90s.
Yeah. And her sister, Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
You knew her?
I knew her.
Yeah, she was also an actress.
She was on Dennis the Menace.
Right.
Yeah.
And lots of things. People would definitely recognize her. And
she was
married to Ezra Stone, who was a director, but he also was the creator of the character of Henry Aldrich.
He was Henry Aldrich.
Henry Aldrich on the radio, yeah.
Yeah.
And then on television, I think he directed them on TV or something, yes?
Yeah.
Did you know him as well?
I knew him. He was great. Uh-huh. He was great. They were all great. They were all wonderful. They were also larger than life. I just wish I'd known my grandfather.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there was that sort of show business side of your family.
There was that show business side that, and my dad always sort of stayed in touch with it and loved it. But I think it was really hard. You know, these were the days before texting and email, and you couldn't talk on the phone.
Yeah, you couldn't be in the business.
You couldn't be in the business.
Uh huh.
So.
And he had directed a couple of things before he became ill.
He was an assistant on North by Northwest, actually.
Wow.
Yeah, and The World of Susie Wong.
Oh, I know that one.
Yeah, and then he had directed his own first feature. He was directing his own first feature when he got sick.
Mm.
But he did cut it. He finished it. It was called Out of the Tiger's Mouth. It's a beautiful movie about two orphans in Hong Kong.
He wrote it also.
He wrote it. He wrote it and directed it.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. Well, that's really interesting.
So there's definitely this sense in the book, I think Katie has a real sense of a past that sort of could have been glorious that's somehow eluded her.
Didn't get it.
It's not a bitterness. It's more of a melancholy.
She says in the book, she says, my mother didn't get the life she expected.
Right.
Is that true with your mother that she didn't get the life?
No. That character is really, really not my mother.
Uh-huh.
It's not. Yeah.
You have a good relationship with your mother.
I have a great relationship with my mother. I mean, not that Katie doesn't, but that's just not my mother's style.
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
I based her on, she's a composite.
Of other people's mothers?
Exactly.
Maybe she's my mother.
Exactly. Yeah, my mother's not that feisty. No. She's just really sweet.
Well, now on the other side of the family, on your mother's side of the family, the kind of the thing that's interesting for me and you sitting here across from each other on these microphones is that your maternal grandfather, right. Alex Bloomstein,
right.
he went by Yale.
Right.
He was a famous psychiatrist in Los Angeles. Right. And his brother, Dave Bloom,
right.
was my grandfather.
Right.
So we share.
We're cousins.
We're cousins, yeah. That makes us second cousins, I
right.
believe.
I
yeah.
think so.
Yeah. And I knew you when you were a little tiny. She was a terrible little girl.
I keep reassuring him that I've gotten calmer.
Yes.
I've gotten calmer.
Well, so far you haven't run amok here in the studio. We're talking with my cousin, Hilary Rill, and her novel is called Lessons in French. Why is it called Lessons in French?
Well, it was originally called Cherche Midi, which is the name of the street that Katie lived on in Paris, but I was told I couldn't have a French title.
So I thought
about French lessons, but there have been several.
I think there's actually a great
memoir called French Lessons. So I wanted the sense of learning of a apprentissage,
mm-hmm.
And then I wanted to evoke France. So it just kind of struck me.
And do you still spend time in France?
I do. I'm married to a Frenchman.
Oh, that you met when you were in France?
That I met when I was in France, and his family actually lives in Geneva. So we go to Geneva a lot, but I still have friends in Paris.
And what does he do? What does your husband do?
He is a physicist. He has a PhD in chaos theory.
Huh.
And you were.
I know all about that. I happen to be an expert on that.
My friends used to joke that he was studying me.
Oh, because you're the chaos.
For his chaos.
Yeah.
Studying my hair in my room. but he now has a financial sort of software company that's a startup called Parity Energy.
Mm.
And we're very excited about it.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So how did you... You always been a writer, and this is just your...
I've been writing. I mean, I actually did a PhD in French literature, because I knew I wanted to write, but I needed to support myself somehow. So I had a couple of sort of entry level publishing jobs, and then figured out that if I got into school, I could get a fellowship, and somebody would pay me to feed my head while I wrote. So and I love French literature, and I wanted to go back to Paris. So it was sort of a way back to Paris and a way to just read novels. And so I had a wonderful time in grad school. I was in grad school for about 7 years, but I was always writing fiction on the side. I have a nice collection of rejection letters for my short stories and a drawer full of novels.
Yeah, so you've written several novels.
Yeah, I've written several novels, and this is the first one that's hit.
Mm, so how many exactly?
Five
novels.
Yeah, I've got five.
Uh-huh. And so do you still have some stories that are rattling around in your head that you
I
want
have
to
lots of stories that are rattling around in my head, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I'm actually reworking one that I love right now. So
mm-hmm.
I'm hoping that my second book will work too.
I hope so too. Yeah. So tell a little bit about the experience of not getting a rejection letter. What was the
It's incredible. It's like such a wonderful feeling. I actually had it almost sold about 5 years ago and fell through, and then I put it away and wrote something else. But it was nagging me. I knew it should have worked. And then I think that I had a couple of plot points to work out. There was a little bit of the romance wasn't quite right, and the arc of the story wasn't quite right, but it really wasn't far. And I just decided that I wasn't going to give up, and I rewrote it. And I found actually sent it cold to a French woman, fantastic French agent named Stéphanie Abou. And she called me up and said, everyone sends me their Paris novel, and they all ring false, and I can never stand them. And I love yours.
Okay.
And she's been my knight in shining armor. And she just went out and sold the hell out of it, and she was great. And I feel really lucky.
It's very exciting.
But, yeah.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
So
And I have I also I've Just one more thing. Yes, she sold it to a woman named Anjali Singh at Simon & Schuster, who's also has a big French connection. She brought all the Persepolis books to the States, and she's the editor of Suite Française in the Nemirovsky, and she's also been incredible. So I feel like I have these two women in my corner.
So did your French editor have story suggestions for you?
They both did. Yeah. They both did. They're both just really bright and.
Well, what's that like working with someone? I mean, here you've had this novel and you wrote it 5 years ago or whatever, and it's there with you, and now you really think it's good, and then they say this and that or the other thing. Is it hard to take that, or do you like that?
You know, when I first got my editorial letter, the 9 single space pages in the Markdown manuscript, I burst into tears. And then I read it over a couple times, and the sort of terror transformed into just this feeling of being incredibly moved that somebody this smart had chosen to shine their light on my book, and that actually it was going to make it much better.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not afraid of work.
Oh, that's cool.
I don't mind rewriting. I'm actually, the blank page is scarier to me than.
So not having any idea.
Is worse than the rewriting.
Yeah.
And it's just so wonderful also, because writing can be lonely. Just to have a really intelligent dialogue with people who care about what you're doing.
So you didn't write
wonderful.
It. You didn't write it in a workshop or that kind of thing.
I had a lot of help. My acknowledgement list is going to be very long. I had some wonderful. I could point to maybe 5 people without whom the book wouldn't have gotten published.
So now that it's there and it's out there. And now you're going to go around, hopefully, and you'll publicize the book, and you'll meet people who've read it.
Right, that's going to be so exciting.
That's going to be a new thing.
Right.
Yeah, because you've been writing all this time without anybody reading it.
Right, and it's sort of a dream to see how it reverberates in people's minds.
Yeah.
And I hope it speaks to most people who, in their early 20s, gone somewhere, had to reinvent themselves.
I spent some time in my early 20s at one time.
Right. And we all...
And
I feel like we're all sort of like queasily nostalgic for that period.
Well, sure. Know? Yeah, I think so. I think people just get nostalgic in general.
Right.
The older you get, the more nostalgic you get. I was just reading something about how Paul McCartney is much more interested now in talking about the Beatles and playing Beatles songs than he was when he first left the Beatles and wanted to, you know.
To go back to that time.
Yeah. So the older you get, I guess, the more nostalgic you get. But, of course, you're not very old.
But the more interested you get also in why you did things. I just think it's fascascinating. I think that psychology at that age is really interesting because you're really not an adult yet.
So did you learn things about yourself then by writing it?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah?
Definitely, yeah. And it was interesting because the first drafts, people were incredibly critical of Katie. They're like, she's amoral. I can't identify with her at all, you know, and I slowly had to make her more likable.
So when she having her kill a guy, that was bad. Killing a hobo with a hammer was a bad idea.
It was a bad move.
I'm glad
you
cut
that part.
I had to
give her a really, really good reason.
Well, it's to me, it's a fascinating process. So tell me a little bit more about it. You know, when you went back and said, I need to rescue this, it really should sell.
Right.
What did you do with it?
Well, I actually showed it to a wonderful novelist named Joanna Hirshon, who's also a writing teacher at Columbia. And she read it and said, I was on the verge of self-publishing it. And she said, you know, don't self-publish it. You can sell this. It's all a question of plot. There are 5 plot points. I'm going to give them to you. And you go back and deal. So again, I just needed somebody to give me a little structure. And so I thought, well, you know, I'm going to believe her.
And are those lessons in French,
right.
That you can now, when I write my next novel, I know.
Absolutely.
And have you already started your next novel? Are you writing?
I have.
Uh-huh.
I have. It's called Baraska.
What is
Baraska
that?
Is the opposite of a bonanza.
Oh, okay.
It's a disaster.
and see. And how far along are you?
I'm about halfway through.
And do you know where it's going?
I do. That's another thing I learned to plot. Mm. I'm a much better plotter. I used to start.
Just start writing.
Start
and see
writing
what
with
they,
an idea and
where
see what
go.
Happened, and it just doesn't work. It doesn't work for me. Mm-hmm. Or it can work, but it's incredibly laborious.
Because you have to make up.
And then
a
you have to
that.
Go back and sculpt.
It's just. Well, that's interesting. Yeah. So are you the kind of writer that goes, you know, like, do you labor over sentences? And,
yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. There's a lot of, and actually that's really pleasurable, but it's a form. It's definitely a form of procrastination.
I can't go any further till I finish this sentence.
Till the sentence is really beautiful. Cause
Where you have a studio? You have a spot where you work, or can you work on the bus, or what?
I have a notebook, and when I'm really like on fire, I can take it out anywhere. But I like to be on my desk.
Mhm. And you're also a mommy.
Yeah, I'm a mommy. So, and I've got people crawling around all the time. So I've got.
How many people do you have crawling around?
I've got 3 people crawling around. I've got 9-year-old twins, and then a new baby who's Iris, who's just lovely. And my girls are Margot and Ella. And they're all fantastic. Yeah. And my daughters are really proud of me. They're still,
really?
The older ones. Yeah, it's so cute.
Do they read, your 9-year-olds?
They love to read. They mm-hmm. love to read. But they, I mean, I haven't given them my book yet.
No, not yet. You don't want them to to know everything
to
yet.
Know everything, yeah.
They have to discover for themselves. But
it's wonderful. It's one of my greatest pleasures is actually when the 3 of us are just lying on the beanbags reading together. It's
won't that be interesting when they're, you know, 20 and they say, oh, look, this is that novel, the first novel that my mom wrote.
Right,
let's read
right,
it.
Right.
That'll be pretty interesting. I wonder what that would be like. What about your mother? Has she read your novel?
Yeah, she's my mom's my biggest fan.
Yeah, well, that's good.
Mom.
That's the nice thing about family, hopefully.
Yeah, no, she loves it. She
that's
loves
good.
It
and your husband is interested in your work?
He's very interested, and sometimes I feel bad because he understands what I do.
Yeah.
It's really hard for me. I can sort of give him support on the in the sort of psychological plane, you know, the people he works with and that kind of stuff. But he's a big reader. I mean, one of the ways we met was that we bonded over Proust. So we're he loves literature too. So he's been incredibly supportive too. So I haven't earned any money in about 10 years.
Oh, that's good. Well, it's a good thing he's got a bonanza. And what's the other thing?
The Verasca.
write that down. But is there anything about France in your new novel?
No.
No, it's Frenchless.
No, it's Frenchless.
Well, when it's done, you'll come back and.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. No, it's actually set in Southern California in the 70s.
Oh, well, yeah. I was there.
I know. I've got to get it right.
That's right. Or I'll let you know.
You can read it for factual errors.
The book is called Lessons in French, and the author, my cousin, Hilary Rell. Thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
That closes the book on this edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time, and you'll come back and see me again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or look us up on Facebook or iTunes. Production assistance on From the Bookshelf is provided by Francis Venegas. Thank you, Francis. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.